a great documentary
makes us question everything. The things that we know and the things we think we know.
But we're actually completely wrong about.
This is the beginning of my last act. In order to know how to go forward, I'm going to have to know where I've been.
The public figures we love.
And love to hate.
The issues that we must face as a society.
Huge cultural moments.
I mean, as a black man, you're born into this world with PTSD.
Things you can't unsee.
The aftermath is worse than the actual levees breaking.
Someone who's different from us, but also
not that different from us.
Somebody offers you $1 million, you're gonna take it.
Documentaries show us the worst
and the best
of what human beings are capable of.
You listen even for 5 or 10 minutes to Liz Carmichael, and even I could have become a believer.
Hello, and welcome to HBO Docs Club, where we dive deep into the true stories that captivate our imaginations. I'm Brittany Luce, longtime documentary super fan, freelance journalist, and cultural critic. You may know me from my other podcasts, For Colored Nerds and The Nod.
And I'm Ronald Young Jr., audio producer, live storyteller, film critic, and cultural commentator. You may have heard me on the podcast Solvable and NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. During each episode, we'll take a closer look at a film or series in the HBO documentary films catalog. Sometimes they'll be from our recent past, other times they'll be brand new, but they'll all inevitably teach us something about the human condition.
This week's documentary is The Lady and the Dale, the four-part docuseries that first aired in January 2021.
The Lady and the Dale tells the story of an audacious 1970s auto scam centered around a mysterious entrepreneur named Elizabeth Carmichael.
All through automotive history, women have played a supporting role in the automobile development, automobile marketing. They never really rose to the level of executive or designer or engineer. Liz, however, was hoping to change all that.
I can do anything a man can do. The time is right for our kind of car.
The series was directed and executive produced by Nick Camilleri and Zachary Drucker. The Duplass brothers, Mark and Jay Duplass, also serve as executive producers. On this episode, we sit down with co-director Zachary Drucker and Susan Stryker, the historian featured in the documentary, to chat about all things Lady and the Dale.
I had no sense of the richness and complexity of the story, and it wasn't until Zachary approached me. Then she was like, we need a historian on the project to kind of help connect the dots, because this is a sprawling, messy hairball of a story. And it was a delight.
And as a heads up, this is your spoiler alert. If you haven't watched the series yet, we suggest you pause this and come back later. Trust me, it'll be worth it.
Okay, let's start off the way we always do with a bit of a recap of this week's doc.
All right, so Liz is ambitious. She's making waves as a woman in the auto industry during the 1970s gas crisis. She also has multiple marriages, check frauds, and scams that put her on the run from the authorities for years. Her latest business venture is creating the Dale, which is this stylish three-wheeled car that gets 70 miles to the gallon, which of course is amazing to have in the middle of a gas crisis. Liz starts the 20th Century Motor Company, which she claims will put the other big auto companies to shame.
We're going to shock General Motors, Ford, and the rest of them right out of their big overstuffed seats.
So 1974 is where things kind of start to go downhill. The company has been on this rise and things just crash and burn. I mean, the money isn't there. The car doesn't really work as promised. And Liz's criminal past comes back to haunt her. So Liz and her family, which includes her wife Vivian and their 5 kids, they have to go on the run again. Liz eventually has to go on trial for her crimes, which, you know, include breaking California fraud law, for taking investor money, spending most of it on herself, while underpaying her employees if she paid them at all. So Liz and her scamming are on trial, and it becomes clear that her crimes are not the only thing being prosecuted. She's facing scrutiny for her gender identity from the jurors, the media, the public, basically. They don't see her as a trans woman, but as a man pretending to be a woman. And transphobia, hate, and bigotry run rampant.
I think most people are interested in our personal life and your sex changed, to be perfectly candid.
Well, whatever claim to fame I have is that as a producer of automobiles, not as a sex change artist.
Can you give us a little personal insight on what this ordeal has been about with you?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of industrial, political pressure being brought to bear against individuals who don't want me to build a car.
So in the final episode, Liz is hiding out with her family in Texas, in Austin, Texas, where she started an off-the-books flower business. But again, she's caught. And again, she's outed by the media. And throughout Liz's journey, we kind of find out her story through this cast of characters that includes her children, her grandchildren, two generations of the very right-wing Carlson media family, historian Susan Stryker, and a bunch of other experts. And they all kind of help us to place this very, very complicated character in 1970s America.
You might be kind of familiar with this breed of entrepreneur, somebody who sells big, flashy moonshot ideas without much science behind them. These are the kind of disruptors that are usually hungry for money, for fame, for power, and sometimes even for blood.
This sounds like Elizabeth Holmes.
Okay, so you smell what I'm stepping in.
There's a lot of confidence, but not a lot of actual science or actual technology behind whatever it is that they're saying. But if we're honest with ourselves, most of the luminaries that we know, whether we're talking about Kanye West or Steve Jobs,
Bill
or
Gates,
Elon Musk, Bill Gates, any of them, they all talk the same. The only difference between all of the way that they talk is whether or not they have something to show for it.
Yeah.
And in this case, Liz did not have much to show for it. And I think that's where the central conflict of the documentary lies, in the fact that she is taking people's money for a concept that is completely unproven. As a matter of fact, the more I think about it, it actually is Theranos. I think one of the strengths of this documentary is like they point out the fact that this was a person that was a grifter.
I like that you mentioned the fact that like the documentary does not make any bones about the fact that Liz was scamming. And that was kind of like her homeostasis. And she was like, okay, how am I going to flip this? How am I going to get over? But, you know, that also makes me think about something that Susan Stryker brought up in the documentary. Susan Stryker was one of the expert contextualizing voices that they brought in, a trans historian, and who was just like brought in at so many crucial points throughout the series to help the viewer really have critical context for understanding the moment that Liz was in at different points in her story.
What might Liz's life have been like if she was born a couple of decades later? Maybe if the world had been a different place, she could have been a different person. You know, I like to think that that could be true.
There is something to be said about the fact that someone like Liz might have felt like if she were to be her whole self, would she be accepted? If she were to be her whole self in public, in the public sphere, would she be accepted at a 9-to-5 job? Would she be able to actually pursue or maintain gainful employment? With Liz not having those traditional avenues open to her, does kind of line up that she would want to find some other way to be able to live the American dream. Liz had that same desire to sell people on a great big idea, like Kanye or Elon Musk or, you know, Steve Jobs. And it's interesting how if the world is different, or if your experience of the world is different, like someone like Elon Musk, whose family has been eating for centuries off of apartheid blood money, right? Okay. Right? If you're like a cis, hetero, white, rich, generations back man, then having that aptitude, like those proclivities and those leanings, can be seen as a positive. Maybe someone like Liz might have just needed to come across an idea that maybe had a little bit more science to it.
I think what I'm saying?
You know what? We should sell books on the internet. Do you know what I'm saying? Like Liz might have been Jeff Bezos, another kind of morally questionable person in a completely different way. But the opportunities that Liz was presented in life did not line up with I think, her potential. Like, even though obviously she was a criminal and she was running a lot of different fraud schemes, she was a highly intelligent, highly confident person with like sort of an infectious ambition.
She talks early in the documentary about watching movies and seeing everyone in their fancy cars and their fancy clothes and how she wanted to be one of them. Like, she wanted more from life than what was presented in front of her. And I think that all of us have that, or a lot of us, or capitalism sells us the dream of wanting that for ourselves, always wanting more, not just wanting to survive.
I was born on a dirt farm, very poor. I did occasionally get to go to the movies. Here I saw people driving fancy cars and living in fancy buildings. And somewhere about 15 years of age, I realized that there was a better way to live than on a dirt farm.
And I think you're right. The approach by which she did it was just not the right approach. But also, later on in the movie, she does do another business venture. And it, like, when she's doing the flower business, it's almost kind of the same concept where it's like, what you're doing isn't a bad idea, but the way you're executing it is morally questionable. Like, this flower business you're doing, it's kind of exploitative. You're kind of helping people, but yeah, are you actually helping people? You would love to say, like, when somebody is this ambitious and they have this many people that believe in her and will follow her, like, and they talk about the energy at 20th Century Motor Car where people would be like behind her.
I can't say spiritual, but there was an energy in that place. Almost like a big family.
They are working, giving me every ounce of what they have to make this happen, to make the Dale happen. And it was hard to doubt that she wasn't going to do it. She was determined.
So there's no question as to the scamminess of Liz, as well as the innovative mind of Liz, the entrepreneurial mind of Liz. Like, there's no question of those things. I think, again, once we get into the investigative reporting aspect, that's when it starts to get extremely transphobic. And I think the ways in which she was dealing with transphobia her entire life is, you know, is evident in the documentary, but it really hits an inflection point when we introduce Dick Carlson. We see Dick Carlson on TV doing the news, and he introduces the story as a story about the Dale car. And then he runs a picture of Liz that slowly fades into a picture of her living as Jerry Dean Michael. He says that her fingerprints match and she's actually a notorious con man, outing her and using her dead name.
Dick Carlson, at one point, I think he says that they did 27 segments of the nightly news on Liz Carmichael in a year, which won him a Peabody. It's amazing how transphobia is rewarded. Okay. So, like, that's already in and of itself. And an issue, right? But like 27 segments on one person. And I think the documentary makes it pretty clear that before, I think Dick was even fully aware of Liz's admittedly shady business deals, he had a serious discomfort with what he perceived her identity to be or to not be. And I think that, like, his discomfort with her existence was something that completely colored all of his work. But beyond that, like, when, you know, we learned down the line that this wasn't just something that Dick Carlson did with Liz, like following her and hounding her specifically so strongly, he did the same thing with professional tennis player Renee Richards, who was outed by Dick Carlson after a La Jolla tennis match later into the 70s. Like, this is something that Dick felt was like his mission to just, I guess, in his mind, quote unquote, expose people. It was really dangerous. Unfortunately, he was able to ascend to finding a place for himself in the Reagan administration once he left local news in California. I'm like, the Reagan administration is popping up in every episode. And it's not looking good. It's not looking good for the legacy there, in case you had any doubts.
Yeah.
What's interesting, though, to me is that, like, decades later, right, we see Liz have another very pivotal encounter with the media and with one journalist specifically. His name is Mark Licheron. He was a journalist at an Austin newspaper. At this point in time, this is like in the 2000s, and Liz has already been on trial for everything that had to do with the Dale. Liz has already cut and run, I think, two more times, and then went back and served an 18-month sentence back in California. She comes back to Austin, Texas, or comes back to the Austin area and starts this flower business, or it reinvigorates basically her flower business that had sort of gotten into, you know, disrepair while she was away locked up. Yeah. This journalist, Mark Licheron, basically moves to the Austin area, sees people selling flowers in the street corner, wonders what's up with that, looks into it.
I'm now bumping up to my Sunday deadline. I'd already established that she's running this rose business based on homeless labor. Everything's completely off the book. She's not paying taxes. She's not doing anything. I've got a hell of a story, but I know that there's more to it. I ran a criminal background search. Through that, I got a hold of an assistant DA in LA, and he said, so you're working on a Liz Carmichael story.
By the time we meet Mark Licheron, he is still exhibiting the same transphobia at the root of his pursuit of Liz and of quote unquote exposing her business and her, but he makes it more about, oh, it's for the story. Oh, I'm getting the story of the year. But the story of the year, while it is in many senses focused on this shady operation that Liz is running, there's still this idea that Liz's identity is a disguise, essentially, and that that disguise is intimately and innately connected to her criminal enterprises. It creates this media narrative that trans people are innately fraudulent. Their identities are innately fraudulent.
They would say things like gender switching, masquerading as a woman, pretending to be a woman. And they would always dead name Liz over and over again. And you could see that. And that was one thing that gets me. No part of me ever stopped thinking that Liz was a scammer for the business practices that she was doing. No part of me ever stopped that. Mm-hmm. However, when she would be giving an interview and they would ask her a question and she would say, we're going to win the case no matter what, as she'd do her like grandstand thing, and they'd ask her a question about her gender and she goes, I'm a woman. You could almost see the actual facade was her business acumen. That was what the reporters should have been after.
Yeah. See, they were really barking up the wrong tree to take Liz down. But I want to get back to that strong legacy of transphobic reporters.
Yeah. So the greatest twist is the big reveal of who Dick Carlson's son is. And I can't wait till we talk to the directors so we can just say, this was the greatest twist when you guys are like, yeah, so anyway, Dick Carlson, this guy, he's doing his thing. And you're like, anyway, guess who his son is? Tucker Carlson reveal, it was funny because it was both surprising and not surprising at the same time.
I know.
It's funny. You're like, oh yeah, that makes sense.
When I watched this documentary when it came out in 2021, me and my fiance are watching, and like, that obviously Dick Carlson is irritating. He is irritating and harmful.
Yeah.
He's meant to seem that way. But I kept looking at his face and I was like, I just feel like I know you from somewhere. Like you favor somebody and I can't put my finger on who it is. And the fact that it was literally Tucker Carlson, who some people consider Satan's spawn, turns out, fact-checked in this movie, that is accurate. He talks nonsense on television all of the time. And talking nonsense and lying are two of the things that Liz was on trial for, I would say, most recently. To learn a little bit more about the docuseries, we spoke to some experts very close to Liz. Co-director Zachary Drucker and historian Susan Stryker, who's featured in the series.
Zachary was also a producer of the Emmy-nominated docuseries This Is Me and a consultant on the TV series Transparent.
Susan Stryker is a historian and filmmaker whose work focuses on gender and sexuality. She's a professor at Mills College in Oakland, California, and she appears in The Lady in the Dale and served as a consulting producer on the series.
Zachary, how did you come aboard the project and what grabbed you about this story?
Well, you know, I had never heard of Liz Carmichael until I got the call in spring 2019 from my friend Jay Duplass, who had just taken the project on. And Nick Camilleri, my co-director, had doggedly pursued this story for a decade from start to finish, and had meticulously created a network of people who knew Liz, worked for Liz, prosecuted Liz, apprehended her, incarcerated her. He had worked his way into meeting and gaining trust with her family, with Liz's surviving family members, children, grandchildren. And I hopped on and we went on the road to interview everybody, as it were. And for 8 months, we shot in the second half of 2019 up until the lockdown, and realized that we had to make do with what we had. And it's truly an early pandemic project. It was created in post, all on Zoom and collaboratively. And we had to really create the infrastructure for, you know, telling a story in a completely unprecedented circumstance and an unprecedented story for an unprecedented moment.
You know, Liz was a complicated character in many ways. She was a trans trailblazer, a female CEO working within a male-dominated industry. She was a parent and a grandparent. She also had a history of crime and serious fraud. How did you approach telling a story that gets to a full picture of Liz and all her messiness?
I would love to punt that to Susan to talk about the intricate kind of like weaving of trans women's identities as women and their relationship to criminality. And Susan, you should take that one.
I remember when the Dale, you know, was making the news back in the 70s. I mean, I was in my early teens at that time. It's like I remembered the story, had no sense of trans anything connected to that. That wasn't part of my memory. And then later on, as a trans person of a certain age who was a historian, it did kind of, the penny did drop for me that it's like, oh, that Liz Carmichael person in the Dale, I, you know, kind of heard about it. But I had no sense of the richness and complexity of the story. And it wasn't until Zachary approached me, then she was like, we need a historian on the project to kind of help connect the dots, because this is a sprawling, messy hairball of a story. And it was a delight. What Zachary was saying about the messiness of the story and the relationship of transness to criminality, it's like, I actually thought it was super important to lean into that, because it's like, as you were saying, Brittany, it's like, you know, Liz is both, I think, a really remarkable person who I'm going like, right on, sister. And at another level, it's like, you did some crimes and that was totally sketchy, you know? And so how do you sort them out? What the complexity and messiness of the story gave us the opportunity to do was, maybe this is me thinking as a, you know, a historian and academic and teacher, is like, oh, this story is so messy. It's got so many threads in it that it gives us a chance, as we try to disentangle them, to teach the audience how to read the complexity of trans lives in a different way. It's like when the stereotype is trans people are often couched as evil deceivers and make-believers, you know, that trans people are pretending to be something that they're not, they're misrepresenting themselves, or perpetrating fraud on people. Telling this story gave us an opportunity to say, yes, she was committing fraud. Yes, she was presenting herself as something that she wasn't, but it actually had nothing to do with being trans. She was a trans person who happened to be involved in some sketchy financial things. And she was a con artist at a certain level. And she was a remarkable person who happened to be trans. And like, let's tell that story in a way that lets us see Liz and all of her messy glory, and do the cool works of teaching mass audiences how to read trans stories with a little more nuance and sophistication.
Zachary, what twists and turns like really stick in your mind as the most surprising or resonant of this story? And I know there's a lot. So which ones stick out the most?
Learning that Tucker Carlson, you know, was the son of Dick Carlson, yes, the primary antagonist. I remember the moment I heard that on set. I mean, that alone, just to know that the boogeyman of Tucker Carlson's childhood was Liz Carmichael, a trans woman. And it explains so much about his, specifically his anti-trans. I mean, I think you can, you know, justify and see his other issues, you know, racism, his white supremacy, his misogyny, but specifically the targeting of trans people and identities is inherited basically from his father, who not only denigrated Liz in the media, but then went on to out Renee Richards, who was the more famous of the two, or the yes, more notorious for being outed.
I think that plays kind of into our next question, which is how biased the reporting was in talking about who Liz Carmichael was and going after her humanity rather than her actions. Susan, how would you describe the way trans people were treated in the 60s and 70s? And what role do you think that played in Liz's story?
You know, I think that the show does a really good job of just showing all of the really sort of like unchecked, unconscious, unchallenged misogyny that, you know, characterizes the representation of trans people, trans women in the mainstream media. And that it was just par for the course, I would say, like even into the early 21st century. It's like, I don't think mainstream media really until like the 2010s kind of fully got on board with this, like, oh, it's like messed up to like talk about trans people that way. And then there's a little bit of a penny dropping there on some of the unstated, unacknowledged biases in the representation. But, you know, one of the parts of the series that I enjoyed doing the most was Zachary had asked me a question. It's kind of like, so, you know, Liz is being totally misrepresented and trashed in the press. It's like, how long did that go back? It's like, how much, you know, how long has this been a thing? And I was like, you know, like, girl, like, we can take this back to like the 18th century, and started telling stories, you know, that I know as a historian about the ways that gender variant, gender nonconforming people were represented in the press.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, it's astounding to see Liz in this cavalcade of people who were just publicly humiliated, institutionalized, incarcerated, and murdered. And to understand that she's a part of a much larger movement through, you know, centuries of history, it offers an opportunity to really see the ways in which Liz did push things forward, being able to self-identify in court as a woman and proudly proclaiming her trans identity in the media. She is in a long line of legends and heroes who persisted and persevered in circumstances that were designed to disempower them. One of the things that was so fascinating for me was when Susan really described the particular confluence of social justice movements in the early 70s and how trans people were kind of expelled from those communities. And Susan, I'd love to hear that kind of historical capsule of early 70s, the things that changed in that particular moment.
I think about how in 1973, that's the year that homosexuality is officially depathologized. It's dropped from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And the Supreme Court, you know, rules in Roe v. Wade that, you know, you have a right to, like, you know, reproductive, you know, control of your own uterus, right? And so there's this feminist movement that's winning successes, you know, my body, my right to decide. There's this gay liberation movement, like homosexuality is not a sickness. And what happens to trans people that year? It's like trans people, you would think, my body, my right to decide. I need healthcare that works for me, and I'm not a sick person, and I'm not a criminal. It's like you would think that those stories that get told about cisgender gay people and women, people would see that, like, oh, like that's important for trans people too. But no, like 73, 74 is the year that trans people kind of get thrown under the bus by the gay liberation and feminist communities. You know, like we really kind of get driven out, witch hunted out of movements that trans people had been involved in, you know, social justice movements, social transformation movements in the 60s and early 70s. And that was hard. You know, that was a hard moment historically. And so I kind of love it that Liz shows up right at that moment, you know, like that hot historical moment of the energy crisis and the, you know, the OPEC, you know, oil wars that are going on, the rise of a new kind of neoliberal economy that makes the idea of a fuel efficient car a super hot topic. Liz seizes that moment, and in the political context of a lot of really overt marginalization of trans people, it's like she like takes this somewhat unwanted moment in the spotlight to actually be like out loud and proud about being trans while she's doing everything else in life.
There were some deceptions involved here, though, weren't there?
They claim there were. In my opinion, there were not.
Why, for example, did you decide to pose as a woman in this transaction?
Well, it wasn't in this transaction. I'm a transsexual. I had nothing to do with 20th Century Motor Car Corporation. I've been living as a woman for 8 years.
What was the one interview or piece of tape that really stood out as key in telling this story?
The key for me was the 1,000-page FBI file in which you're able to really track Liz's journey through the 60s. You know, it dates back to, I think, even the late 40s and through the 70s. And at some point, you know, we really used the FBI file to tell the story of the first episode, which is relying heavily on animation because, of course, it's a text document. But one thing that was particularly interesting to me was witnessing the FBI not having the imagination of Liz being trans. And what I mean by that is they continued to pursue Vivian, her partner, and you can see in the documents that they've interviewed former neighbors who have said Vivian now lives with a roommate, a female roommate named Elizabeth. No information can be found about Elizabeth. And they didn't have the imagination to realize that Geraldine Michael, the person they were pursuing, was Elizabeth Carmichael. Like, they couldn't create space for that in their imagination. You know, it just didn't occur to them.
If Liz were around today, what would you want to ask her? I'm especially curious about your perspective, Susan, as a historian and a scholar.
The big takeaway for me, you know, it's like about, you know, kind of where the series wound up was not even a question about, oh, this is a trans history story. To me, it became a question about the need for restorative justice. You know, like the United States incarcerates more people, you know, and primarily people of color, you know, than any other country in the world. We have a prison epidemic in this country. And so many people get caught up in the carceral system. And Liz is somebody who I will just say, you know, whatever fondness and, you know, right on sister attitudes I have about her, she did a crime. She hurt people. She took advantage of people. She was convicted of felonies and she served her time. You know, it's like, okay, you know, and still people went after her. You know, she was stigmatized as a felon. She was stigmatized as a trans person. They would not let her go. And like that sense of how you hold space for welcoming people back into your community who have done harm and how they make restoration. That's so important to me. And I did see Liz as somebody who later in life, it's like, I mean, she made family, she built community, she gave people jobs. It's like she was, you know, she did good in life besides doing crimes in life. And, you know, I would just hope that that's a perspective that we can hold, you know, as a society to forgive, to move on, to restore, and to find justice in that.
Zachary, there's something you do in episode one in particular that surprised me. You use Liz's old name and pronouns.
The subject, Geraldine Michael, operated a small newspaper over a local grocery store. The subject did not enjoy a very good reputation in the community.
It seems that that was a deliberate choice, and I want to know more about that.
you know, in the first episode, we tell, I mean, we tease the story of Liz, and ultimately we tell the story of before she transitioned and her life as Jerry Dean Michael on the run. And there is kind of a turning point in terms of how family and friends refer to her. And it's a curious quandary, I think, with storytelling in that in the present, in the real world, when you're talking to people, you just go with, you know, the person's name and pronoun as they're presenting it to you. And that's the record, you know, like the record stands, you know, as it's stated. And in storytelling, you're moving through time. And it's more complicated, and you find these kinds of narrative quandaries that you have to figure out. So that was certainly something that we had to navigate. And the reality was that Liz's family referred to her in different ways. Her children and grandchildren only ever knew her as a woman and as Liz, with the exception of Candy, who's, you know, the eldest daughter. But the grandkids didn't know that Liz was trans, or many of them didn't. And then, of course, you know, the people who knew her before tended to still use he/him pronouns and refer to her as Jerry. We'd editorialized a little bit to be consistent and respectful, but by and large, it mirrors the messiness in our own lives. I have a huge extended family. Everybody makes their best effort to use she, her pronouns, but certainly there's just, you know, some people in your life that always see, you know, a 10-year-old child.
I thought you did a great job of capturing all of this in very, like, narrative format. Like, I think documentary is very strong in being able to present a story like this. What do you think that a documentary about Liz's life does? What does it capture that a fictionalized version of the story could not?
I mean, it's impermeable. Like, you can't argue that somebody exists in history. We have always existed. We have always existed in documented history. And yeah, I think that there's something undeniable about real people who lived in history. It's not a, you know, an extrapolation of people on the left and coastal cities. We are everywhere, and we always have been.
I think trans lives are especially suited to documentary storytelling because it's like, it can just be so weird, you know, to other people, like the things that actually happened. It's like, I kind of talk about it, like when I'm like trying to sell stories, you know, about trans history, it's kind of like, this is a little acid I'm going to drop on your tongue. It's going to blow your mind what actually happened, you know? And that if you were writing it as a script, you know, some studio exec is going to be sitting there going like, I don't believe this. It's just too weird. It's just like, you know, it's like, could you make it a little more realistic? And so that if you can go, no, dude, it's like, this is actually what happened. It's just like, it's a better story. And I think it's actually a well-told trans history documentary changes audience perceptions about what is possible and true and has actually existed in the world, you know, rather than like, oh, like that was a really clever story that I enjoyed hearing. That was very inventive. It's like, nope. It's like, this is kind of, this is something that the world actually has already held and is actually already real. And you just didn't know it. The world's a different place than you thought.
I love that characterization. I think that's brilliant. How would you describe the current landscape for the way trans stories are handled, both in the media and in Hollywood? We know there's been quite a change. And how do you see The Lady and the Dale fitting into that landscape?
For me, it's like, of course we want to see positive media representation. Of course you want like young trans kids or gender questioning kids to see something that says like life is possible and success is possible. And then at another level, some of those, you know, what I think of as like sort of like rainbow flag pride stories, it's kind of like, okay, it's like, it's a little boring. Sometimes the happy story isn't the interesting story, but it's like, oh, messy story involving crime and duplicity and bad actors and, you know, nefarious villains. It's just like, it's a more interesting story. So I was glad Zachary was able to do that. I think it made its mark.
Oh, thank you, Susan. That's, yeah, I mean, I feel like people are being true to themselves and they're contradicting themselves. And there are so many contradictions in Liz, and that she gets under your skin, and she's a really compelling protagonist, and that we as trans and non-binary people can only be fully human if we can contradict ourselves, if we can be, you know, as complex as everybody else.
I think you guys nailed it. I think there's something to be said about being able to be human as being true equality and true equity, which is like the same thing, you know, like Black folks, women, everybody's been struggling with. Just tell a full story. We don't have to be regal. And like you said, you don't have to be like noble all the time in order to have a complete picture of that. So let's flash forward 10 years into the future and look back. What impact do you hope Lady in the Dale will have had by then?
You know, I'm just going to say, I just feel like I am on the knife's edge right now of like hope. And I don't want to say despair, because I don't think despair gets you anywhere. But we're in a very dangerous political moment, very dangerous historical moment. I hope that I have the luxury 10 years from now of looking back and thinking about a TV show. You know, when I think in the biggest picture, most cosmological kinds of ways about what does transness mean? You know, I think that we who are trans have this, I don't necessarily want to call it a mission, you know, but maybe a calling or an avocation, you know, to just say, you know, like we know because of what we've experienced in our own life, like what our own needs are, what we need to do to survive, what we know in our bones is that deep transformation is actually possible, and that it's something that, you know, kind of begins in your heart, but like it requires your relationships with other people. It's always social. It's always about world building. It's always about engaging in the real transformation of the world in a way that allows your survival to be in it. It's not just a simple minoritarian issue of like, oh, some people change gender. It's like, no, some people have found, for the sake of their own survival, a capacity for deep transformation of self and others. And what we need to do, I think, as trans people, is just bear witness to others that this is the capacity that we all have, that deep change can be real. And I think, you know, I look ahead at the next few years of our life in this country and on this planet with a sense of foreboding. You know, I'll just say that. And you know, and so there's a window of opportunity, I think, where we just have to, like, you know, leave it all on the dance floor, man. You got to like make all your big table bets. You know, you've just got to put out there the world that you want to be in and the way you want to be in the world. You make that world come into being through your actions or you die trying. And, you know, at one level, Lady in the Dale, it's a TV show for HBO, it's entertainment, but it is also part of collectively imagining a world together in which trans people can bear witness to our power and what the world needs to hear from us, and it becomes part of us all collectively reimagining a future that is worth living in.
Thank you both so much for joining us today. It has really been an honor to speak with both of you.
Thank you so much, Zachary and Susan.
Thank you so much for watching this show and for engaging us in this conversation.
Likewise, great to meet y'all and to see you again, Zachary.
So those two were amazing. I feel like getting to hear Zachary's perspective as a director and Susan's as an expert on trans history, like, it really painted a full picture of what went into telling Liz's story.
Brittany, I feel like hearing what Susan said about trans lives being uniquely suited for documentary, that really landed with me. There's so many different kinds of stories about marginalized folks that sort of get erased from history or rewritten by folks who like completely don't understand them.
No, yeah. And I feel like both Susan and Zachary really drove home just how important telling these kinds of messy stories is, like the stories that are not all rainbows and sunshine, but are just genuinely human. It made me think a lot about why these documentaries are so important and how just bearing witness to injustice, whether it's, you know, decades of transphobia or any of the other large scale issues that, you know, these documentaries have addressed, like it can really force us to interrogate our societal past and think about, you know, what we hope to change for the future.
Agreed. That's really well said. Well, that's all we got for today.
Join us next time when we take a look at The Apollo, the Emmy Award-winning documentary that chronicles the unique history of Harlem's Apollo Theater and its enduring legacy today. Until then, I'm Brittany Luce.
And I am Ronald Young Jr. And this has been HBO Docs Club. HBO Docs Club is a production of HBO and Pineapple Street Studios. It's hosted by me, Ronald Young Jr.
And me, Brittany Luce. Beyondrea July is our lead producer, and our associate producer is Maria Robin Somerville. Additional production support from Natalie Peart.
Darby Maloney is our editor. Hannes Brown is our engineer and composer. John Asante is our senior managing producer.
And our executive producers are Barry Finkel, Jenna Weiss-Berman, and Max Linsky.
So when talking about especially the 60s and the 70s, one thing that stood out to me, oh, Brittany's coming back now.
Ooh, that was weird. All the power just went
there
out.
You are.
I don't know what happened.
Yeah, we watched it happen.
I saw you looking around.
What? It was a real Godzilla
moment. We saw you looking
moment.
Around.
And I was like, what? Sorry, go ahead.